I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. I first encountered Marjorie Simmons in 2016 when she emailed me after it had been suggested by mutual friends that she be in touch. She and her beloved Silver Donald Cameron were making their way west in late 2016 to winter in the milder climes of Metro Vancouver, from where they made their home in the east in Nova Scotia. Both Don and Marjorie are originally from Vancouver. I was delighted to have both Marjorie and Don on the program as soon as they motored their way across the country. They both came into the office at home to chat, first Marjorie on a book of hers and Don on one of his, and then we did one with the two of them. I saw firsthand their affection and respect for one another, and not just as married people, but as writers, and it was lovely seeing how they supported one another. I look up from my desk now at a photograph from that sunny November day, a selfie of the three of us. It's with the warmth of that memory that I sat at my desk recently looking up at that photo on the wall from time to time as I read Marjorie's latest book, In Search of Puffins, Stories of Loss, Light, and Flight. The book looks at Marjorie and Don's story, their love, their life together, and the loss after Don's death at the height of COVID in June 2020. Don's still around, as you'll read. Certainly throughout the book, he's like a character, a voice through the book, guiding Marjorie or giving her a laugh. The book is also great at illustrating grief and how hard it is to navigate. Marjorie, during Don's final days, and how she goes about to a new chapter in her life is damn near heroic. Marjorie joins me again, and I'll ask her about how she finally got writing again, especially finishing this book. I'll ask her about wanting to move back to Vancouver, but how she found that unfeasible. There's a lot in this book, a lot that's useful, but a lot that's just worthwhile, as Marjorie's a great writer. In some parts of the book, it reads as poetic. The website for more is at marjoriesimmons.ca. This new book is from Pottersfield Press. We taped this interview nearly 2 weeks ago with Marjorie joining me from Truro, Nova Scotia. Please welcome back to the Planta Online program, Marjorie Simmons. Ms. Simmons, good morning.
Hi, it's a good afternoon here, and I'm delighted to be with you.
It's nice to talk again. You know, I can't help but thinking as I was reading In Search of Puffins, just the sort of gift you've given readers. In terms of this insight into this life with Don, not just with this book, of course, but with Coastal Lives too. You know, we see in that book how you met and how you, and now how you contend with his loss. Do you feel as though you're sharing not just for the reader, but for yourself, say?
Well, I just thought if there was a beginning, a middle, there had to be an end, which sounds a bit dramatic, but I just needed to write that third memoir in the series, the third and last in that series, to honor Don and to honor other people who are going through the same sort of loss and recreation.
And grief isn't the same for everybody, so whatever you went through that helped you through, I mean, it might help some people, but it won't help everybody, will it?
Oh, no, and you know, I do want to say that it's not a how-to. What's very obvious to me at this point is everyone has their own very particular way of getting through really big emotional challenges. I was simply glad that the things that had always supported me throughout my life, my dogs, my horses, my friends, I would just felt very lucky that I still had those things to call on in my life.
Yeah. The other thing that I was thinking about was, you know, because it's nearly 5 years now since Don has died. You know, I remember just how shocked I was and saddened when I heard the news. And I remember posts of yours online on social media some weeks after about what to say when someone dies. And you know, as someone who's gone through losses, you haven't written about it now. Do you wonder, I mean, you're a writer. I mean, do you find that we in this culture and in this sort of zeitgeist have the words to say when say trying to comfort someone who suffered loss?
Well, you know, it's kind of a big subject. I hope I didn't say anything sort of obnoxious online afterwards about that, but it made me realize that I had said really things that had no business. You know, just you just sort of go on too much. Mm. Basically, the Cape Bretoners have this right. Simply say, I'm sorry for your troubles. And if you don't say that, just say, you know, my deepest sympathies or whatever it is. You don't have to say, oh, you know, no editorializing, no additions. You just, and I've been guilty of this over the years. So just short and sweet is basically the best advice I would ever give anyone.
You tell the story in the book, and I was going to mention this later, but it might be a good time now. The pounding at the front door after Don's memorial there in Cape Breton. Somebody wanting a book of his? did that happen?
Well, you know, in fairness to this lady, it really did happen. I had just come literally from the grave site where we'd had a very, you know, wonderful service. My brother did that for us, being a minister. At any rate, I'd just come home, and I was just cross-eyed with fatigue more than anything. And there was going to be things going on later that evening and so on. So I thought, well, I'll just lie down for a second. And no sooner had my head sort of hit the pillow than bang, bang, bang on the door downstairs, front door. And so down I went. And, you know, here was this lady. Now, she didn't know. I mean, it was the middle, you know, I don't know, 3 o'clock in the afternoon or something. She had no particular reason to think I was doing anything other than living my life, you know.
Yeah.
But she didn't seem to take in really what was going on, because, you know, sometimes when people are on a mission and they want something and they're like, well, I was just hoping I might get this book or something, and I just had to repeat that I had just come from his funeral. And she reluctantly sort of backed off from that, you know. But I found that people were quite possessive of Don, you know, and so we would get people coming to the house and wanting books or wanting his time or simply wanting to tell him sailing stories. And Don was just unflaggingly polite and welcoming. It was me that was kind of glowering in the corner saying, you know, I don't even know you, buddy. Why are you here?
You recount in the book so many wonderful stories of Don with other people, but especially the conversations that the two of you would have over the years. I mean, I just found that just wonderful to hear and a wonderful insight into that relationship that the two of you shared. It seems, you know, almost dramatic that the 2020. When he died in June of 2020, that was probably one of the worst times to pick a time to die, because we were in that unknown period of you know, what people to let in our lives, or you know, we couldn't gather, if you will, and you weren't able to be with him for a part of the hospital stay, right?
Yeah, number of things to respond to there. Thank you for your kind words there. And I really did try very hard to capture Don's voice as accurately as I could. And yes, we got into trouble just as COVID was rearing its very ugly head. And of course, as soon as I say that, I realize that thousands of other people were in the exact same boat as I was. But of course, you just feel very alone. And yeah, basically I would be sitting in my car in the hospital parking lot, and we would be talking, you know, on our cell phones, or occasionally he would come to the window of whatever hospital he was in and, you know, give me a little wave or something like that. And it was heartbreaking. It was just like, oh my gosh, of all the times you want to be with your sweetheart, it's when they're in trouble and you want to be useful and loving and kind and all those good things. So when, in fact, they said this was now in Halifax, but when we moved to Halifax Hospital, when they said, you know, Marjorie can now come in, we both of us nearly had a heart attack, because we knew what that meant.
Yeah.
And so, you know, part of you, your heart just leaps. You go, yes, I can finally see him. And then the other part of it is just you're just deeply shocked, because they are saying that he's in real trouble, you know.
Yeah, and you had to bear all this, of course, with your family, Don's family, being far away. So to have to do it alone. I mean, I read that now in the book, and I can't help but think how heroic that is.
Oh, well, thank you. The thing about life is it makes the demands it will, and you just have to rise to them. There's no particular choice, you know. The good thing about both my family and Don's family is we're huge communicators, all of us. So there was emails, and there was texts, and there was phone calls, and there was, you know, so there was a lot going on that way. There was Zoom calls, I guess. That was starting to, you know, roar into the forefront, you know, at that point, too. So I certainly had, you know, loving voices coming at me and loving words coming at me, as did Don. But, you know, as I think I conveyed in the book, it was just so brutally fast. You know, from getting in trouble to dying was 30 days, less than. And, you know, it just bewilderingly fast. And again, this happens every day to families, you know. There are certain things that come into a family that take away a family member very quickly. And I knew all that, but it just, you know, when I came home to the house, and I mean, at least I had the dogs, thank goodness, the two Shelties, but you just feel as though somebody slipped something in your drink and, the world is on a tilt and everything is just so peculiar. But again, that must have happened to thousands of people across the country. And there were some people who did not get to be at the bedside of the person they lost. Some people were barred completely, and it differed from hospital to hospital, from province to province. You know, so in fact, I would consider myself very lucky that I was with Don for the last 2 days.
Yeah. In the book, you write about how this grief unmoored you, and you know, as it should, I guess. But you know, you mentioned the two Shelties. You had to get up for them, didn't you? And I mean, you couldn't simply take to your bed and grieve. I mean, you had two other people in the family, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Shelties are probably the politest dogs on the planet, but they too need to void themselves in the morning and have something to eat. And, you know, so you'd hear the gentlest of little, you know, and so up you'd get. And as you know, I was also motivated to work on other areas in my life because it kept the grief at bay. And again, everybody's different. Everybody's so different. I mean, some people simply want to. I remember reading not too long ago about some lady who said she cried every day to the point of immobility for about 3 weeks, and thereafter got on with her life. I didn't do that. I felt like it was an ocean that I would have jumped into and not been able to swim out of. So for me, work was a godsend.
And you also had Don's book, which was coming out, that, as I recall, that fall, which would go on to become a bestseller, and you were promoting that through the fall, because we talked then, I think, right?
Yes, his incredible book, Blood in the Water, describing the murder that happened on Ile Madame in the 2000s, I can't remember the precise date now. This was all so sad, you know, because of course I come from a family of writers, and they were all praying and praying that Don would get to see his book go on the bestseller list, because I knew it was going to, everybody knew it was going to, it was a masterpiece. It absolutely was just a phenomenal book to sail out on. And instead, he did pass, and the promotion, I mean, there was just no way I was not going to do that for him. I mean, that's another motivation, I think, that people feel when they lose a beloved, is that if I can do some work for him on his behalf, it feels so good. Yeah. You know, I will speak for you. I will promote for you. I will, you know, tell the world how wonderful this book is. I'll tell them how hard you worked on it. Even the court proceedings that went on day after day after day, and he was there every day taking notes and, you know, having a good time. But at the same time, those were long days. They were complicated days. Mm-hmm. But the book, you know, one of the things that Don was so very, very good at was taking masses of complicated information and morphing it into a beautiful, clear read. Like he, as a technical writer or any, he would have been a fantastic science writer. Well, he did with The Living Beach and so on. But that trial was massively confusing and complicated, and he made the book just so gripping. So it was my honor to promote that for him. And I gotta say, I laughed, when he was on the bestseller list week after week, and I'm just like, yes!
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't help but give you a cheer from over here every time I read a great review or then your heart broke because you wish that he'd have been around to know that. You remind us in the book about this terrible shooting in Nova Scotia in April of 2020, and as I recall now, Don had quite a moving piece in the Globe and Mail, I guess soon after. Is that right?
That sounds right. Yeah. That sounds quite right. That was so surreal, in part because we were in Cape Breton. Mm. So oddly enough, I'm now in the community.
You're there,
where
yeah.
Yes, I'm in Truro, and Portapique is not very far from where here. Like 20-minute drive. So it would have been, now I understand why my friends here in Truro were just, distraught. I mean, don't get me wrong, we were shocked and saddened and all the rest, but it's a little different having it in your own backyard. And now I've been to the areas where some of the troubles went on, and, we could barely take it in. These are beautiful, quiet, rural communities. I'm not going to say the fellow's name because he doesn't deserve to be named. I've actually forgotten it. That's how strongly I felt about it. But yeah, it was like it was the start of all that went wrong afterwards, this huge event. And then so shortly afterwards, Don, being unwell.
Yeah. Well, why did you have to move home after Don's death? I mean, in retrospect, could you have stayed in the house that you chaired?
Yeah, a lot of people ask me that, and it's sort of a logical question to ask. I just felt that every single time I would come through that back door, through the beautiful backyard that we had made, that every time I came through that back door, I would be looking for him and expecting to see him and sad that I didn't see him. I was also originally pretty keen to return to the West Coast because I really, really, really wanted to be near my family. And when that couldn't work out for me for any number of reasons, and I came to live here in Truro, I mean, sometimes you just got to shake your head because it's as though somebody really is guiding you sometimes, like just because I wanted something doesn't mean it was necessarily the right thing to happen. It's worked out so very well. I miss Cape Breton. Mm-hmm. I miss the people there. I keep close with them, my special people that I've known for so many years. And I go for trips there, and I'll do one of my book launches is this week, on the 22nd, up in West Bay. But I just felt as though Ile Madame had been Don's choice over 50 years ago. It was a beautiful choice for us. We had lovely, lovely years there. Two sets of years, 9 years, and then another five. So it's beloved territory, but I really felt as though I needed a new chapter.
You mentioned coming back home to Vancouver. When we first met in 2016, you and Don had come across the country in an RV. As I recall, you both had planned to winter here, but the bigger plan was to move here eventually. Is that right?
Yeah, good for you for remembering that. I mean, I think, poor Don, he sort of expected that I would change my tune over the years. And I did, and I didn't. I've come to love Atlantic Canada with a pretty deep and abiding love and passion. I simply do. It is different here. It is wonderful here. It is like, I don't know, it's like a warm cup of tea and a ginger cookie. It's just, it's so good here. And there's still parts of me that miss the West Coast. I mean, I was formed on the West Coast and basically came here when I was, call it 40. I was 39 pretty much when we came here. So I love both places, and I know that's a very common thing too. I mean, you meet people all the time and they say, oh, I'm from the prairies, but we're in Atlantic Canada now. We love it, but I still sometimes, you know, long to hear the particular birds on the prairies or whatever it might be. I think it's very a Canadian thing to love several places with just, you know, deep love.
And that comes through, not just the deep love of Atlantic Canada, but obviously the deep love of Vancouver and the West Coast. But for you, it wasn't going to work out, and financially was one of the big reasons, right?
100%. It just would have been, I had a friend who said to me, how did she phrase it? Live rich on the East Coast and live poor in the West. and that would have been it. You know, I mean, I am not well-to-do. Let's get that straight right now. I'm a writer, for heaven's sakes. But that said, I have an incredibly rich life. I mean, I have a dear little house on a dear little bit of property in a dear little town. I could pay my bills here. It's not a problem. I can take little vacations. I can pip off to London if I want. I can't stay in London, but I can fly to London and have a little trip. You know, all of this is manageable. But on the West Coast, I would have been trading all these nice things for maybe, you know, 400 square feet somewhere in a place in a suburb that I don't want to live in.
Yeah.
And then, could I afford my life when I was there? You know, I mean, I talked to my family and, you know, about various things that I get done here and, you know, what people charge me and so on, even from a haircut to anything else you can think of. And they think I'm lying. They're going, are you kidding? And I'm going, no, that's, you know, people are decent around here, you know. But it's hard to explain, you know. There's just certain things that I miss kind of with all my heart. Things like those cherry blossoms, those darn cherry blossoms, you know. I'm where I need to be now.
Yeah, that comes through in the book, and it's obviously a long journey for you to work out in your head about where you want to be and where you need to be, and that's one of the marvelous things that's resolved in the course of the book. You remind us in the book about Don writing in an earlier book of his Seasons in the Rain, this wonderful line, paradise will be Spanish Banks in the sunlight, purgatory will be Marple in the rain. I mean, he wrote that, what, about 50 years ago?
Oh, my God, yeah. I mean, that was one of his earlier books. And that line, I'm so glad you picked that out, because, it makes a Vancouver person laugh.
Yeah.
It just does. And it's a bit of an in-joke, right?
Yeah.
And but it's also, it was so typical Don. It's just, bing, it's the truth.
Yeah.
It's the truth.
You know, I had the other places in the book that, because the book is often humorous as well. The stories about Don, like the hiding the chainsaw because he didn't like you cutting down trees, and then you finding it eventually. I mean, I've done that to one of those portable vacuums where I've kept it too long in the socket to charge, and it's unworkable afterwards. And then the hiding of the cardboard from the toilet seat. But the one story that got me was when you moved to this house that you're in now, and you met the mailman for the first time, and he introduced himself.
Yes. You know, this is where again I you can't help but feel guided. I mean, this is day one that I'm here. I've only been in my new house for like 2 or 3 hours, obviously. There's things everywhere. There's moving men bringing stuff in, more stuff by the second, you know. And, you know, up comes the postie up my little ramp by the side door there. Charming-looking fellow and holds out his hand and goes, hi, I'm Dawn. Welcome to the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And, I pretty much nearly fainted right there. I do have Celtic blood in generous measure, and I do sometimes think that we can hear from our departed ones.
Yeah.
Like, honest to God. And that would be typical of Don. He would think that was a real thigh slapper. You know, like, ha ha, got you there, baby, didn't I? You know, and he's done that since then, too. But, you know, he just, I do. I was guided to this house. I call it the Good Luck House. You know, the second I got here, good things started happening, and they keep on happening. So I do feel guided.
You narrate in the book your own spirituality or attending church regularly and singing in the choir. Were you a regular attendee at a church, say, before all
Absolutely
this?
Absolutely not. Yeah. No, I had had one full year of going to the United Church near UBC when I was about 10, 11. Mm-hmm. And I did that because my best girlfriend at the time, she and her family went to that, attended to that church. And she said to me one time, would you like to come with us? And I, not knowing anything, I said, sure. And so I did. And it's funny because we were so young, but we didn't actually go to Sunday school. We went to the regular, service for the adults and so on. And I remember just barely being able to keep my eyes open, just, not being really drawn to the subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
But I did it for a year, and thereafter I said, thank you very much. I think that's fine for me. And thereafter, my family, became connected to the wonderful Unitarian Church at 49th and Oak there,
oh, yeah.
which I adore. And that's, mm-hmm. of course, where we got married, Don and I. And my little sister got married, and so it's kind of a family church in a way. My mom worked there for many years with the wonderful thrift sale that they have once a year. I don't know if they still do that, but it used to be one of the best thrift stores, thrift events,
yeah.
Of the year. So we were connected to the Unitarian Church, and then my brother became a Unitarian minister just in time to marry Don and I. So I've certainly had, spiritual elements in my life. It's something I work on now. But as I said in the book, you can as readily call me a pagan as you can a Christian.
Mm.
I take great, great, peace and joy in being out in nature and all its wonderful offerings. But I have no problem with, the United Church. In fact, I love the United Church because they're very politically active. We are in an affirming church, which means that everybody's welcome. And every single Sunday, our lovely minister says, everyone is welcome, and that's the kind of church. I want my church inside to look like my world outside. I don't want it to be different.
Yeah.
I wish we had more young people. But so, yeah, it's been actually an interesting and unfolding spiritual adventure, which I continue to enjoy.
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing to read in the book because, we're all looking for something in our lives. And I'm happy to read that part of the book and see that it's you found something. I mean, again, it may not be for me, but it's nice when you have that sort of grounding, if you will.
Yes, and remember, it was very much a way for me to connect to the community as well,
yeah.
Not knowing a lot of people. And now I see the people in our congregation all over, which is really nice. So it's kind of, just a way to get to know where I am here and how these people are connected to it, most of whom have been here, years and years. So that's nice for me to talk to them.
Yeah. You mentioned just a moment ago that you were married at Oak and 49th. I thought you were married at Point Roberts.
No, we were staying down there.
Oh, I
that
see. And
year.
That's when you crossed the border in the wedding dress, right?
Yes. We called it the honeymoon cottage because
yes.
We didn't actually have a honeymoon. So we called it the honeymoon. And yes, no crossing over from, Point Roberts, Washington to BC or, what is it, whatever it is, Tawson there.
Yeah.
And crossing over and the scowling little Canadian guard said, purpose of your visit? And I'm sitting there in a wedding gown and my girlfriend's just looking at her like, come on, give us a break, right?
Yeah. So we also read in the book that Dawn rests both in Cape Breton and Point Roberts, is that right?
Yeah, that was, it's funny because we had, like most people, we had had discussions about how we thought things should work for either of us if, whoever went first kind mm-hmm. of thing. So we had some good laughs about that, too, which I won't go into. But at any rate, I had tried my best for him to reside, shall we say, in one spot. Mm. And he basically said to me, well, if you don't put me in Cape Breton, I'll come back and haunt you. So I didn't have much choice, but I had, you know, I got the last word when he was alive and said, yes, but part of you is going to reside at the family cemetery in Point Roberts as well, because that's probably where I am going to reside, and I would like to see you in wherever it is, paradise.
So it is a private, I didn't know they had cemetery. I guess it's a private cemetery they have, that the family has there, is that right?
Yeah, they had bought it years ago. They bought the family cottage down in South Beach, in Point Roberts, and that was in the 40s, I guess they bought that. Yeah. It was a long, long time ago, and, you know, it would have cost a song, an absolute song, and as did the cemetery plot. So it was just something they thought would, well, and it turned out to be a very good thing, because, as I mentioned in the book, Don lost his dad when he was only a teenager. He was only 14 when his dad died, so it hadn't been very long since they'd actually acquired the plot. It's another one of these things where you go, do-do-do-do, you know, and then the poor gentleman did die young. He was only in his 40s. So that was the first person to be in that plot, followed many years later by his wife, Don's mother, and so on. But you don't. It's kind of an older fashioned thing for more rural for people to have, you know, cemetery plots. You know, although in Vancouver you think of Fraser and 41st, and of course that would have been like way beyond the center of the city when that thing was put up, right? And now, of course, it's right in the city.
Yeah, we were talking about that. I was talking to a family member about that recently, about, you know, what'll happen to me when I go. And I thought, well, you know, since I live so close to Mountain View Cemetery there, then I went online to look at prices. And I sort of felt like you in the book, and I'm just like, well, I can't afford to die now, can I?
Oh, my God. That's the worst thing ever. But, I mean, honest, yes, well, not dying this week. For sure. But, you know, I'm glad to hear that you're actually talking with your family, because it's just nice to think that when we do hop the twig, that our family members will honor our wishes.
Yeah, indeed. You also talk in the book about finding it hard to write, and I can't imagine how hard that would be for a writer, especially someone who makes their living as a writer. And thankfully, because of the book's been published, you manage your way through it. Do you have any advice? I mean, we started the conversation about advice and what not to say to people, or what not to, you know, how not to read in the book. But I would think that in terms of writing itself, there must be some wisdom that one might be able to glean as to how to get through the grief that you got through, to get back to writing even.
Well, yeah, I understand what you're saying. Again, I wouldn't sort of put advice out. I would simply say, for me, the process couldn't be pushed. I had people saying, well, aren't you going to write, you know, a book about Don? And I said, well, I've, you know, written two. And they said, yeah, but what about the concluding book? And I said, well, we'll see. You know, so it was in my mind. And the first two chapters were actually written as standalone pieces. So you may notice that they just read a little differently than the rest of the story. They're very complete on their own, and it was sort of a strange thing, because your writer's brain not only creates words and stories, but it's always looking for structure. It's always looking for ways for those words and stories to actually make sense on a paper and then in a book. And what happened was, I wrote those two pieces separately, and then I was reading them one day, and I really worked on them, and I polished them, and I loved them, and loved them, and patted them, and, you know, that was about the best I could do with those two pieces. I couldn't do any more. And then I looked at them, and I went, oh, son of a gun, there's chapter one and chapter two. Mm. And, you know, there's grief, and there's denial. There's loss, and there's denial. There's chapter one and chapter two. And that kind of opened up part of my brain that had been sleeping or something. I don't know how to put it, but it was just like, Oh, well, if you've already got two chapters, heck, just see what happens if you can do a third. Mm. So it was very much like everything else in this whole process, one foot in front of the other. And, you know, but the way I write books, once I get my teeth into them, is charge of the Light Brigade. So that's what happened. You know, chapter one and two must have taken, like, I don't know, 6 or 8 months of fussing and tinkering and, yeah. and all the rest of it. And then thereafter, I just put my seatbelt on here at my desk, and I was off.
Did Don ever find writing hard?
No, he used to laugh about this. He'd say the only people that talk about, you know, writer's block and this sort of thing are people that don't pay their bills. He said, I have a keen interest in staying solvent and paying my bills, so I find that it keeps my backside in the chair and producing.
Yeah.
Nobody could produce like him.
Yeah,
I mean, I think I said, and it was Coastal Lives, that, you know, I come from a family of workers. Like, we know how to put our head down and work. But I had no comprehension of the word until I met Don. He worked like three people.
What did Don think happened when we die?
He had a fairly, he had a fairly intense interest in reincarnation, maybe earlier in his life than when I came along, but it was still something that he entertained and thought about. And so he thought maybe we got another crack at things. And he felt, actually, at various points of his life, he had that feeling that so many of us get when you just enter a certain situation or you meet someone and you just think, do-do-do-do, been here before, yeah. Know how to do this. Why do I know how to do this? I've never done this before. Most people have those sorts of odd experiences or meeting someone and just thinking, holy Dinah, I know this person. So he did think that, but he was, you know, I mean, the last thing in the world Don would ever be in a million years would be evangelical. Like, he was totally not interested in pushing anyone one way or another. And, you know, he had been affiliated with the United Church for some years, all his growing up years. And, nobody could thump out a hymn like he could on the keyboards, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
He really could. But, yeah, he was open to the idea that we would get another chance at things, perhaps in a very different guise.
Well, I can't tell you how much I enjoyed seeing Don again in this book and hearing his voice as you share with us through conversations you had. And just the life that has come out of his loss, and it's such a marvelous book. I can't help but thank you for writing it. As a reader, I can't tell you how much I got out of it, and I'm sure a lot of readers will be telling you that.
Thank you so much. I really, really appreciate that, Joe. I mean, it wasn't difficult for me to, this is sort of an odd verb, but to sort of channel his voice, you know, because we had so many conversations about so many things over the years, and I feel that that's a true representation of Don in the book.
Yeah.
You know, even when he gets, you know, the part where he gets mad at me, yeah. That would have been Don. Like, don't make me out to be in my dotage. You know, that would have been Don. He wouldn't have been all warm and fuzzy about that. He would have been like, oh, for God's sake, just get over this, you know, on with it. So I didn't want, he's real. He's sharply defined, I certainly do hope, you know, and nothing, it's music to my ears for you to say that you can sort of, you know, you can hear him too, and you can, and sort of smile and go, yeah, that's the fellow I'm at.
Yeah, and I think that the person that talks to you now, I think, is the same person. And
oh my gosh, yeah.
You know, I can't thank you for the time today. It's been so nice to talk, and I hope when you're out on this side of the country, I'll be able to see in person.
I would absolutely love that, Joe. Look for me when the cherry blossoms bloom one of these times. I'll give you a ring, and we'll talk again. I thank you so much for this opportunity.
The website for more is at marjoriesimmons.ca. The book is called In Search of Puffins, Stories of Loss, Light, and Flight. It's published by Pottersfield Press. It's author Marjorie Simmons. Joined me on the line from Truro, Nova Scotia in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.